Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. I'm here with my co-host, Burl Love. And we're just really getting in the swing of the news for the year, I feel like.
I think that it's picking up, isn't it?
Yeah.
Locally, we're off to a little bit of a sluggish start when it comes to news. Now things are picking up a little bit.
So a little... Have I said this on the podcast before? If not, I'll say it again in case for new listeners. Every January, my husband, Alex Coolidge, and my friend, Dan Horn, who works here, will testify, will be able to say, because I'm like, there'll never be another news story, even though I've been doing this for, you know, at least two decades or more, that I just always feel that way in January. And then now that I have a long
February is almost over, so it's about time, right?
Yeah, that's true.
It is about time. I think we were talking about how, you know, usually in January, the Bengals are still playing. You know, they exited early. Usually we have a lot of weather happening. We had some, you know, scary winter weather advisories that kind of fizzled out locally here.
What? Here?
Where our neighbors to the north got pounded and everything like that. But
one thing that is going on, our special guest today is Brad Winstrup, Congressman.
Congressman Brad Winstrup.
We've talked about this before. He's retiring. There's 11 Republicans running for a seat and a Democrat. So that's like the hottest race going in our local primary. And so we're going to just have him on to kind of reflect back. We'll try and pin him down on who his favorite is.
Well, yeah, lots to talk about with him. He's not going out with a whimper when it comes to, you know, he announced that he wasn't running for reelection, but he said he's wanted to finish the year strong. He's involved in lots of powerful committees. So we'll talk to him about what he's trying to accomplish before he officially retires. But speaking of that Republican primary and the election coming up, we made a little bit of our own headlines recently here, Sherry, with our candidate survey that was sent out to Republicans.
Oh, people didn't
and Democrats.
People didn't like them.
And by
not people,
one person in particular. So let me set the stage a little bit. We are preparing our pre-election coverage, including election guides that feature some pretty basic questions, survey type questions to the candidates. And so our team has been sending the questionnaires out to both parties. We are in a primary, so similar questions, but separate sets of questions to Republicans running for county and statewide office. Same with the Democrats. And in Hamilton County, Chairman Russell Mock took exception to the survey and urged the Republican candidates running in Hamilton County to boycott our survey. So,
I mean, I'm always on, you know, the side of more information, but, you know, I guess not everyone is.
Well, so the questions,
I mean, they have 11 candidates. How do they expect people to differentiate between the 11 candidates if you don't answer any questions? Do you want people to go in? You can't even roll a dice. A dice has six sides. Like, how you have to differentiate, like explain why you would like to be the person votes for.
I have two thoughts on this. There are many Republicans, not just candidates, but passionate Republicans who start from the default position that the media leans left and they need to be wary of traditional media. I hate to say mainstream media. And some of that criticism is justified. However, in this case, and I will read the question that Russell Mock took exception to, and we're asking this of Republicans. Two questions, actually, and they relate to the front runner in the presidential primary, Donald Trump. Question one, how would you describe the events at the Capitol on January 6th, 2021? Second question, if Trump is convicted of a crime, should he hold office? Would you vote for him? Russell Mock said that, and I quote, I find the survey to be deeply biased and unfair in its questioning of the Republican candidates. January 6th was a terrible day, Mock said. It was a terrible day in our history, but I truly believe that elections are about the future and not the past, and I think that we should start moving forward. And I just think it was very unfair to ask those questions to local candidates. So, okay. Yes, there are probably local issues that we could focus on, and our reporting certainly will be focused on that. But I do think it is a question that, by design, will help voters distinguish between the candidates. And I think it's a valid question, with Trump being the front runner. If, you know, the issue is if he's convicted, and he's, you know, defending himself against all kinds of, in several lawsuits, the most serious of which is, was there a concerted effort on his part to thwart the results of the election? So, you know, it's fused with politics, obviously, but in our defense, I think
they're politicians.
Yeah, they should answer tough questions. You know, we don't want to throw them softball questions that they all agree about. Most of the Republicans have similar platforms. This is an area where you can maybe distinguish between, you know, the candidates if you're looking for, you know, if you have strong feelings about January 6th, if you have strong feelings about whether or not Donald Trump should be in the running if he is convicted in any of these cases, it's a valid question. And even if it wasn't valid, I think the politically smart thing to do would be to answer the survey, and in your survey answer say, I don't think this is an appropriate question, and here's why. But to boycott a survey put out by the Cincinnati Inquirer just because you didn't like the questions, I think was a little weak. And of course, I'm biased.
Not to have a discussion with yourself about it before you did that. And because it is an open-ended, you know, we don't just send things out into the ether and we're sitting. We have conversations with people that we cover all the time. I know people can call you, and I think that we both know I've sent people to you.
Absolutely.
To tell them to talk to you. And I think that you do have thoughtful conversations with them. Like, were there better questions? Like, I'm fully on board with the questions that we asked, but what were the better questions? I'd like to know what they think they are.
Well, and
then let's talk about them.
And in terms of, are we fair to the Democrats? The first question we asked, do you support Joe Biden as the nominee for president? Why or why not? So Democrats could have similar complaints saying, let's focus on the local issues. Why are you tying us to the presidential nominee when that week when the survey came out, there were newly surfaced questions about his mental capabilities to serve in office. We didn't get any blowback from Democratic candidates wanting to distance themselves from, you know, Joe Biden. So if we were really trying to pick on Republicans, I don't think you would have seen a question asked of the Democrats about Joe Biden. I think it was, we're going to ask the Republican candidates questions about the front runner in the GOP race for president. Likewise, we asked the Democrats a question about incumbent Joe Biden. So anyway, politics, politics, politics. It's a little early for what we call crazy season to start, but I think it's already here.
Well, early voting starting, so everything seems to be
early voting starts this week as we record this podcast. Well, let's just float right on through with this political narrative we have today and bring on our special guest.
Welcome to Special Guest Time here on That's So Cincinnati. I'm excited to welcome Congressman Brad Winstrup to the podcast today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Are you just, so we're, as we're talking now, we're recording on a Monday. Are you like headed to the airport?
Tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning.
7:20 flight.
I suspect you're very familiar with these flights.
Pretty much so. Yeah. Yeah. We've got a routine down. Absolutely.
So we're definitely not pushing you out the door, but we were very surprised to learn in November that you weren't going to run again. Mm-hmm. So kind of like a retirement. It's your 12th year in. And so we wanted to catch up with you and talk about all the changes you've seen and the good you've done and kind of like your career in Washington. Yeah. But again, we're not pushing you out the door just
Thank
yet.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
There's work to be done, right?
There is. Somebody said, are you just so relaxed now? I said, no, I am extremely busy because I feel like there's more things I want to get done. You know, I chair the Doctors Caucus, co-chair, and that's 20 of us in there. And I'm chairing the committee reviewing what we did during the pandemic, you know, what worked, what didn't work, what do we do in the future, how do we prepare better, those kind of things. Which I've been very interested in. I sit on the Intelligence Committee, and the world's on fire right now. So I'm not bored, and I'm not without a lot of things to do. And I also sit on Ways and Means Committee, so a lot of things that we can deal with there on trade, tax, and especially in my case, health. You know, as a physician, that's near and dear to me. And my goal there is one of the things I want to do is create the more narrative, you know, in Washington and probably across the country. When you talk about health, people start talking about Medicare, Medicaid, Affordable Care Act. I want to talk about how we can make the country a healthier nation, right? What are the things that we do that can make us healthier individually and as an entire nation, and make that our goal rather than maybe just having insurance? Obviously, that's a part of the equation, but what can we do? I mean, we're talking
about— talking about like eating healthier and exercise, yes, or beyond that?
That's part of it. But I mean, you know, new innovations, new cures, new treatments. But you're right. You know, I have a friend you probably have interviewed, maybe Susie DeYoung of La Soup. And, you know, she says, I go into schools, the kids don't know what a vegetable is. I mean, so we got to start looking at the whole health picture and how we're doing as a country to make sure that cures can get there. Like right now, the FDA has approved Ozempic, right? And for weight loss. But CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, won't pay for it. Okay? So
that's
unless you're in a trial, it's hard to get, right?
Yeah.
And if you can reduce obesity, so I have a bill that would allow two of those types of drugs to be covered by Medicare, and everyone follows what they do, right? So two of them approved by them for coverage, but also allows a doctor to refer you to a nutritionist and or a dietitian that is part of the whole program. So it's not just take this pill and we're going to eliminate a problem. It's multifaceted, but you know, you cut down on orthopedic problems, heart disease, diabetes, all these other things. So anyway, I got off on a tangent.
But
on
I
that.
Do feel
well,
like
that's
I...
a good point. To, I mean, for listeners who only know you as their congressman or a member of Congress, you are a doctor, a podiatrist. That's a foot doctor. I had to remind myself just to make sure. No, I'm kidding. So you bring that to the job of a congressman. Like you said, you're on the health committee. And then during your term or during your time in Congress, your background as a doctor brought national headlines as well. I kind of want to put a little bit of the Brad Wenstrup story out there before we get into some other things. I was actually still at USA Today in DC. I have to remind myself of the date now.
June 14th, 2017.
2017, when during the GOP softball practice, shooter open fighter. Baseball, that's
baseball.
Right.
Yeah. Practice.
We play
practice.
The game at Nats Stadium. It's 27,000 showed up last year.
So
for charity.
You were one of the congressmen that actually jumped into action. I wrote down the quote because I remember reading it and I wanted to get it right. Of course, Steve Scalise, the majority leader, was shot. And he was quoted as saying, I heard the words shooter down, and in seconds, Brad Wenstrup was by my side. I call him my hero. I'm here today because of Brad Wenstrup. There is no doubt. Talk to us a little bit about that day.
Sure. I would just have to say that my military experience is a year in Iraq, where I was chief of surgery at Abu Ghraib Prison, where we attacked 3-4 times a week. I just went into that mode that morning. By the grace of God, I had changed my mind from going out to the outfield, and I went down to the batting cage, which I didn't even like because the machine's wild. But I went down there, which was outside the fence of the field. And keep in mind, these fences at this field are about 20 feet high. A few things happened that saved all of us, actually. One is that Steve Scalise was there, because Steve took a bullet for all of us that day. 5 people were hit, but Steve was the most serious. And Steve has a detail since he was in leadership. They're undercover. They're sitting in an SUV. And if they weren't there, this guy could have easily killed 20 to 30 members of Congress and their staff trapped in the baseball field, which would have changed the balance of power in the House of Representatives in one morning. Think about that. So anyway, the guy apparently, you know, he had names of Republicans in their description in his pocket. He was living in his van, we found out, for 2 months across the street from the Y, which was across the street from the baseball field. And that morning, it's about 7 o'clock, I just stepped into the batting cage and I heard the first shot. And it was Trent Kelly who yelled, "Shooter, got a gun." He's a 2-star general in the Guard, been to Iraq a couple tours. He was at third base, and the only reason this guy missed Trent Kelly was because as fate would have it, the groundskeeper locked the third base gate the night before, which is where he started shooting from. That first shot, you can go there today and see the link in the fence that he hit, and that's how he missed Trent Kelly. But he got Steve on the next round. And so I went into Iraq mode. I got down. And from where I was, instead of being in the outfield, I could see the shooter. I could see Capitol Police. I could see everybody running for cover. There were 136 rounds fired that morning. Most people do not know that. Most people think it was just, you know, one shot hit Steve. No, this was a back and forth for almost 10 minutes. And when the shooter came around, he used the third base dugout, I guess, to reload. And then he came closer towards the home plate area. And a lot of people dove into the first base dugout. Fortunately, it had 5 or 6 steps. And this is a public field. You know, I grew up, you had a bench maybe. And so they actually had a dugout. That saved a lot of lives because you could see the bullet holes, you know, at the dugout, but they were low enough to avoid getting hit. Several got hurt diving in there. And at this point, the Capitol Police are engaging. One of the Capitol Police of the two, she got hit in the ankle, so she was down. She couldn't return fire. One of the members had his 10-year-old son there that day, and he's laying under somebody underneath a car. But all the car tires, the SUV, car tires were shot out, windows shot out. Then the guy came around. Now he was firing down my lane where I was on the first base side. And so I could see the blaze of his rifle. And so I went and got behind a bathroom, which was cinder block. And he disappeared behind this building behind home plate again. And when he came out this time, he didn't have his rifle. He had like a 9mm, just a handgun. And that's when the one remaining Capitol Police and two from Alexandria Police closed in on him and were able to hit him. And as they were yelling, "Stay down, don't get up," I took off. Apparently there was a sniper in the back too that I didn't know about, from part of the Alexandria Police. So it was pretty harrowing morning. I mean, I have to say, for whatever reason, I guess because of war experience, I was never nervous. I was like, I know what to do here. And when I got out to Steve, I saw his entry wound, but I swept his body looking for if he was hit more than once. And it was just once, and I did what we do. I pulled down his pants, expecting to see an exit wound, hopefully on the lower part of his leg or something like that, but there was no exit wound. So now I knew he was very seriously hurt, that it went up, went through his hip. He's bleeding internally. He was still talking. I asked someone for a belt, so I put on a tourniquet to at least stop that bleeding from his femoral artery. But my mind went to a soldier we lost in Iraq, where we didn't get in the belly soon enough because we didn't see it. He had a blunt injury, but it tore one of his internal iliac arteries, and he bled out because we didn't get in there soon enough. And that's what I was worried about with Steve. So I made sure he stayed still. Then when medics came, I did put on a military tourniquet, and I asked him how quickly they could start an IV. And they said, we don't have it. Well, they had it on their ambulance, which they couldn't drive out there. So the medic knew what I was talking about because I said, Steve, start drinking. You need fluid in your body some way. We got to do this. Mm-hmm. And he did. But he was not conscious anymore when he left. And the medic knew what I meant and that we need to be careful. I said, you know, if anything's clotting, you know, don't move them hard because we don't want to stop that. He got out of the ambulance, but as luck would have it again, or divine intervention, a helicopter landed on the field. If he had gone by ambulance, he wouldn't have made it because of traffic and everything else. This helicopter landed. It was part of park police, and they can fly anywhere. They're not restricted over the Capitol. And I met the guy who then took Steve to the hospital, and he flew, I think he flew Apaches in Iraq. And he said, I flew that bird like I stole it. And when Steve got there, his blood pressure was down to nothing. So they started pumping him with blood and took him
back. So we're talking minutes.
Absolutely. I mean, everything had to happen the way it did, or he wouldn't have made it.
So, including you getting there and assessing and starting treatment.
Yeah, I mean, it was, again, God put me in the right place at the right time, and not out in center field either. Because then I'm one of the ones getting shot at too immediately. So I was in a safe place, could move when I had to. And that's just, everything was just army training. And that was my response afterwards. And my army training kicked in.
How long were you a reservist?
25 years, just retired last year. When I went to Congress, I got on staff at Walter Reed, and they would usually call me in when we had a lot of wounded coming from mm-hmm. overseas. And but then I'd go there regularly. When I made colonel, I had to take an administrative job too. So I was at Walter Reed, and then I was medical policy advisor for the chief of the Army Reserve, which was at Fort Belvoir, and they're both in the D.C. area. So I had a good run.
So there were probably some weekends you didn't get to go home because you had duty.
Correct. Well, I was able to schedule, like, if our fly-in day was Monday, I would schedule to be there on Monday, and then we didn't vote till 6:30 at night mm-hmm. anyway. So I'd get a full day, and I'd go in Sunday night, get a full day in. But a couple times they just would call and say, "Are you in town?" And I tell people, when we left Afghanistan, that was one incident where I happened to be in town. We weren't in session, because of the withdrawal, I went back to D.C., and then they called, and I said, well, I won't be at that press conference because I'm going to be at Walter Reed. And so that was, it was all such an honor. I can't tell you. Never thought this was where I'd be in my life. I didn't plan on running for Congress, right? So
take us back to that time.
Yeah.
Remind us why you decided to run.
Well, it really goes back to me joining the military. And I joined the military in 98 because we kept getting attacked. And I thought, if we need to go somewhere, I'll go. And then 9/11 happens. And next thing I know, I'm being called to Iraq. And you know, it was sudden. I got a call on a Monday. You need to be in Birmingham on Thursday for your evaluation before you deploy. And then the next week, you need to get up to Fort McCoy with the unit you're going to deploy with. They're already there. And fortunately, I was in a large orthopedic group, Wellington, and they're like, we got you covered. You know, we'll see your patients. We'll take care of everything. And they did, gratefully. But I was gone 15 months. A couple months at Fort McCoy and then in Iraq for a year. So after I came home, you know, we don't have a base or a post here. So I was kind of the face of the war for a while for the Cincinnati area. And, you know, people wanted to talk. And I did a presentation at Cincinnati Athletic Club about my tour, and I had slides and this and that. And, you know, we're at Abu Ghraib prison. So it was very interesting. We're there after the scandal and we've got Saddam under our care. I operated on Chemical Ali, who was responsible for the genocide of thousands and thousands of Kurds. So very interesting mission. And then people heard about that and they said, are you going to give that talk again? I heard about it. And I said, well, I can, why don't we do a Veterans Day event? And so we made a big event. You know, we had it at Montgomery Inn's conference center when they had that. And we charged $15 and we made $15,000. 450 people showed up. And so then I started getting asked to speak at a lot of things. Kiwanis, Rotary, I'd done over 100 talks in uniform where I'd go to surgery, throw on my uniform, go to a luncheon, and then go back to the office and see patients. And that's when people started saying, yeah, you ought to run for office. And then they talked me into running for mayor of Cincinnati.
Oh, I remember.
Yeah. And, you know, Mark and I got along. We just knew where we differed. And it was a good race. Interestingly, after I lost, although I won the early balloting, which just shocked me. And I was like, at 10 o'clock, I was still up. And I thought, I'm going to have to change the end of my speech here. but he pulled through at the end. And
you had written a concession speech?
Yeah, of course.
It was just an attitude.
It was a general optimistic speech, but with a certain ending, like thanks everybody for your support,
right.
You know, whatever. And so, you know, a few months later, he got to know me through all this and he said, hey, you know, I heard you talk about being concerned about the health of our citizens. And I have an opening on Cincinnati Board of Health. Would you consider it? And I did it. And it was great. And it was a great experience before going to Congress to have some more public health experience in my background. And I was a residency director at the time, too. That was another thing that, you know, parlayed into the things that we deal with in Washington, D.C. So obviously public health and residency programs as part, it's under Ways and Means Committee. So all of these things played out. But
and for our listeners' benefit, we're talking about Mayor Mark Mallory.
Yes. We are.
Yeah. So can we say he launched your political career inadvertently?
Running against him, I'd say did. And, yeah. But he didn't hurt it.
Yeah.
I remember Howard Wilkinson was with the Enquirer at the time, and he said, well, that's pretty strange that your opponent, you know, gave you this position. And I said, well, you know, we talked about these issues, you know. And he said, well, that's a pretty good post. I said, Howard, it's volunteer. There's no big payoff here at the end. This is all volunteer. But a great experience. And
preparing you for
people.
What was to come in many ways.
It did, mm-hmm. Really, yeah. And so it's a three-year commitment. And at the end of 3 years, I got elected to Congress. So, you know, things worked out there and no regrets. But yes, why run for Congress? Well, I looked at Washington and I said, you know, we've got a lot of people in Washington that make business decisions and they never ran a business. I started with my own practice, then joined a large group. I was operations chair and vice president of the group. I said, we got a lot of people making military decisions that never served. We got a lot of people making health decisions that never saw a patient. And, you know, I think that's what our founders had in mind. You know, we had, when I got there, we got Bob Gibbs from Ohio, who's a farmer. Well, guess who I go to when we're talking about the farm bill? I want to hear what Bob Gibbs thinks of it. And I do give the advice. I had someone come to me, a young man one day said, I'd like to be in Congress someday. What should I do? And I looked him right in the eye and I said, something else first. Do something else first, and then you bring something to the table that you can relate to. You know, I said, I know Congress is an open book test most of the time, but it really helps if you have the real-time experience on the issues that we're facing and that we're putting things out that the American people have to live by. So,
I mean, you skipped over like a super important fact, but I think you're just being modest because there was that very important moment when the Enquirer called you Dr. McDreamy.
Oh, I knew.
In 2009.
I can say I had nothing to do with that. I wasn't even here. I was even back. I, talking about military, I call this phase my second tour duty at the Enquirer, but I was between tours of duty at the Enquirer when that happened, I'm sure.
You're absolved.
I'm absolved.
I had nothing to do with it either, but it is a memorable uncomfortable moment. It was at the height. It was at the height of Grey's Anatomy.
It was. It was. And I. But it is interesting because I think the Enquirer on a couple occasions has tried to claim that's what launched me. The Enquirer story could be. Who knows?
No, that mayoral run was very important. Of like, and what happened before that, and prompting that. That was. Really, that was before that. There's no getting around that.
I had fun running for mayor, actually. I mean, it was hard work, but I met a lot of people. You know, I built a relationship with the president of the NAACP at the time that is still one of my close friends, which is Christopher Smithman. And we've become very close. Our families have.
So I want to spend a little bit of time. Something else that had you in national headlines was your involvement with the subcommittee on the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah.
I want you to reflect on that a little bit. And you had said that one of the things you had hoped to accomplish was in the rearview mirror to really understand the origins of the coronavirus.
Sure.
Bring us up to date on that, if you could.
Yeah, so, and we're still going on. So this runs through the term. And matter of fact, it was one of those things that when I was asked to do that, I said to my wife, we're going to stay the whole term. I mean, we knew this would be the last term. I said, we're definitely staying the whole term because this is probably one of the most important things that I had the opportunity to do. So it's pretty broad because we're looking at everything. We're looking at the bills that Congress passed, you know, to try and help the country economically and people keep their jobs. And did it work? How well did we do? But we're looking at the effects of school closures. We're looking at the nursing home deaths in New York. We're looking at the Operation Warp Speed, which is the Doctors Caucus. We were very much involved with what was going on. We'd have virtual events with Dr. Fauci, Dr. Collins, you know, the Doctors Caucus, what's going on with the trials. So we're looking at now, too, at how we report adverse events. We're looking at the effects of mandates on America and how well or not well that was received by the American people. So it was very interesting because I'm on Intelligence Committee, and so it really put me in a good place. I was looking at, you know, our adversaries' bioweapons before COVID hit. And then when COVID hit, we were in lockdown, and I'm talking to another doctor in Ohio, and he said, I can't go in and do cases, surgical cases, so I'm just researching. What we were looking for is how do we treat this? What's going on with the human body? And, you know, what's the best way to treat it? Because we didn't have tests. We didn't have vaccine. We didn't have any definitive cure. And while we were doing this, we're doing a lot of research. And then he sends me this one article, and it was from Ralph Barrick in North Carolina working with Zhengli Shi in Wuhan, China, about making a chimera or a gain of function virus and showing how you can do this. You can take two viruses and make them. Well, the premise behind that type of research I found out because going back to finding other articles, Dr. Fauci and Collins were talking about it in 2011, all in favor of it. Well, if we can create this virus and create the vaccine, then whenever a virus comes along, we'll be prepared for it. And well, they even asked him, they even said, this is kind of risky. And they even said, in one interview, Dr. Fauci was asked, well, aren't you worried about creating a pandemic? This is in 2012. And he said, well, I think the benefits outweigh the risk. And I'm like, okay, that's your opinion. You think this is a beneficial thing to do. I'm of the opinion right now, we should never do it. Not only that, we're at a time where if you want to do it, I understand enough about how this is done. I'm no expert, but enough of how it's done. You can do this through AI. You can figure out what kind of virus might be coming through AI. And there it's just on a computer and prepare yourself for it. So we've come a long way since he said that in 2012, but admitted there's risk. And, you know, now you see that we were doing this with China and we were giving, NIH was giving given a grant to EcoHealth Alliance, which was doing gain-of-function research in Wuhan, China at a less-than-safe lab, Whereas American scientists said, I'd never do it in a, what's called a BSL-2. Must be a 3 or 4. But that's what was going on in Wuhan. So we started finding all these things. I'm just gathering, you know, facts as we know it here. But regardless, I look at this committee as an after action review and lessons learned. People were making educated guesses on things, on what we should do. And that's fair. Sometimes they didn't turn out to be right. You know, they said, well, it's a coronavirus. They'll usually disappear in the summer, you know, or go down. And I thought that's an educated opinion, you know, but it didn't happen. And we didn't really say that to America. We didn't do a good job messaging either. I mean, I had told Secretary Azar and the Trump administration, America needs to be hearing from the doctors treating COVID patients. Not the politician.
Well, it did become very political, and it still is.
Yeah.
When you look back, is there any way to take politics out of it?
I'm trying to with this committee. I don't mention Republican or Democrat ever, and neither do our reports. Unfortunately, the other side of the aisle has done that in their interim report. And I'm disappointed because I asked the ranking member, who's a doctor I've done bills with before, you know, I said, you know, let's do this together. I think we could do a good job together, but politics is entering from both sides of the aisle on some of this. But at least at the top, I'm not letting that be the occasion. These are the facts. These are what happened. Did it work? Did it not work? I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say it's not a good idea to take COVID patients and put them in a nursing home in New York with people that aren't infected. I mean, that I treated a lot of infections in my career. And you isolate people with very contagious infections. You don't put them around vulnerable people. So, you know, you look back and you say, well, we should have made sure, we should have really focused on the vulnerable people, you know? And even, you know, when you go to the mandates for the vaccine, look, I vaccinated people. I got vaccinated. I got COVID. We ignored natural immunity. When I was told I needed a booster, I got my antibodies checked. A strong number was 40. Mine is 821. So doc might say, I don't think you need a booster, right? Mm-hmm. Young males, you see myocarditis occurring to kids after the vaccination. Well, it was after the second dose. My recommendation was if you feel a need to get it, you get the first dose because that gives you most of your coverage. And just hold off on the second dose because that's when myocarditis was kicking in to kids this age, right? This is a county commissioner asking me that. Well, the school board said, no, he's got to get both. The school board saying that. What happened to get a note from your doctor, right, for school? What happened to that? The mandate took doctors out of it completely. There was no conversation about, yes, you're vulnerable. You're not very vulnerable from what we're seeing. Or, you know, the type of advice that maybe I gave in that particular case. You know, you don't seem to be vulnerable. And we took the doctor out of the equation. I wrote a piece on it. I said, oh, doctor, where art thou? Was the title. You know, we've taken that away. And so we're still learning what's going to happen long term.
Do you expect a big report to come out? Like, yeah, well, are you able to?
Yes.
Can the work be done before you're leaving? Because it is a big job.
It has to. The subcommittee only runs until the end of this term. So I hope to have it out around October, if we can.
So you're telling us kind of a lot of what you have seen and learned. Mm-hmm. Are there things that you have learned that you can't say from being on the Intelligence Committee? Are there things
are definitely
top secret?
So I'm working in two lanes right now because I chair oversight on the Intelligence Committee. So yes, there's definitely things I know there that I can't talk about. And the other committee is not classified. So it'll be a combination. But a lot of times you can get some of these things that are classified now unclassified for the American people. I want the American people to have a public health system that they can trust. And I just didn't see a lot of good bedside manner taking place during COVID, you know, where we were having a heart-to-heart. And, you know, we learned a lot. For example, EcoHealth Alliance got that grant to do that type of research in China. But they first were going to the military. There's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. They went there. DOD, Department of Defense, who has intelligence agency, Defense Intelligence Agency, they came back and said, this is too risky. We are not going to be doing a grant for that. So then they went over to NIH. So this is interesting. Dr. Fauci says, well, when somebody comes for a grant at NIH, an NIAID, which he's in charge of, he said they go to an advisory committee that looks it over, and they decide. And once they decide that, all I do is sign it. And I said, well, and they weren't doing their periodic reports back to NIH. As a flag go off, he goes, I don't know. That's over in compliance. I don't have anything to do with it. And I said, well, how about when we're doing research, we're issuing grants for research in a foreign lab, what kind of oversight do we have over that lab? He said, I wouldn't even know how to do that. So we've got some things to correct there. Didn't it seem like first of all, if you're going to do risky research in a foreign lab, I think you should get an intelligence brief before you okay that. And so where does that break down the process? So there's things we can fix, and I think we need to fix. Look, NIH does a lot of great work and has forever. So I'm not trying to pick on them, but I'm picking on a process that seems to need better oversight, if you will.
When we were talking about how political it became, Dr. Fauci sort of became the, I don't know, he quickly became vilified, especially by members of your party who thought the initial response was way too aggressive. As you said, took doctors out of the process, even though he is a doctor. How would you grade Dr. Fauci?
I think he's a brilliant man. We had 2 days with him, and I think he was honest. He's the one who told me that process, right? You got to remember what was being said. Oh, if you think it came from the lab, you're a conspiracy theorist, and we're taking you off social media. And people were losing their jobs or threatened to lose their scientists, okay? And yet, during those 2 days, we asked him, and when we had Dr. Collins in, we said, do you think the possibility of a lab leak is a conspiracy theory? They both say no now. So
is that hindsight's 2020, or do you think that there was some reason on their part that they wanted to keep that?
I don't know why they changed their mind. Look, he got a group together to write a piece that said it came from nature. It's called Proximal Origins. It's been read more than anybody. If you read it as a scientist, it's based on assumptions. If this, if that. And I can tell you right now, what they were saying is, well, these bats over here in Yunnan province somehow got together with pangolins that are over here. They don't hang out together. And either they got together and this new virus was created, because there's a sequence in COVID-19 that looks like a pangolin. The backbone looks like a bat. Okay. Or did some other animal interact with both of them, pick up these two viruses?
At an open market.
No. And then, okay, this animal's here, this animal's over here, southwest, southeast, and then suddenly appear at a market north of both of them. The odds of that are pretty, pretty low. And what we're really finding is, evolutionarily, et cetera, they're saying, no, it existed before the market. And also, you got to keep in mind that when we got the sequence, China held it for a while, but it was taken from a human, right, who had the virus. We've never found one in an animal, which we have for MERS and previous SARS. You found the animal that had this. Never found an animal. And if you're doing research, and Dr. Fauci confirmed this, whether you're just getting viruses from nature, you put those sequences in a data bank. When you're creating a virus in the lab, you put it in the data bank. There's another thing called serial passage where you keep running it through animals and it keeps changing. So that can be gain of function research also, not just scientifically piecing pieces together. And so, you would put that in a data bank. So if the sequence we got came from the human being, that sequence may have already been in a data bank. China got rid of their data bank. They destroyed it. So They got a new ventilation system. They had people from the lab get sick in the fall before it went big. You start putting all these things together. Where I want to go, though, we want to be prepared as a country to, whether something comes from nature or from a lab, be ready.
Because there's legitimate reasons for a virus to exist in a lab. I mean, that's how we learn about the virus. That's how we develop treatments. It's not necessarily sinister that it could have happened in a lab. The issue I think you're getting at is we just want to know.
Yeah, surveillance is part of it. You know, you're getting these things because viruses do and have historically gone from an animal, mutated a little bit, and then suddenly more infectious in a human. This one, though, if you look at what EcoHealth Alliance wanted to do and said they wanted to do, is exactly how you can create COVID-19. And scientists tell you, yes, we can create this now. We have this technology to be able to do it. And so does China. And we gave it to them. You know, we were doing this research with them, which I never quite understand why. But the idea of collecting these viruses is for surveillance. Does something look like it may start infecting humans soon, right? You want to see these warning signs. I don't have any problem with that. But creating one that didn't exist before, that's what's being done. And we were funding it. I mean, and I think you're going to hear more and more people say, this should be like a worldwide ban on doing this. And especially with AI, I had a hearing, we did at the Ronald Reagan Institute, and it was on biothreats and AI. And so we had experts in those fields come in and some really smart people. But you can do these predictions through AI. You know, you can sort of do the evolution by computer, so let's not do it for real, all right? Because it's a whole lot safer on the computer than it is out in the public.
So you clearly super care about this issue, and you've learned so much, and you can tell you've put so much effort into this. Hmm. How hard a decision was it to make to leave this job when there is, like, it's not over in October. Like, there's still so much to do and learn and look back on.
Well, if you talk about that issue, but it's health in general that I'm very passionate about, and what are best practices and what can we do, especially for those that just don't always have access to care, et cetera, right? But, you know, in this particular case, this is a pandemic. This is global. So the committee is only 2 years. So that was the decision that we're going to stay the whole time, where we've got some members that are leaving now from both sides of the aisle. So
what made you decide to leave?
Family. Joe Dieters, who your audience would know, Joe Dieters,
yes,
right?
Yes, they would.
Oh, yeah.
Joe Dieters texted me, and of course, Joe was a year ahead of me at St. X High School. We've known each other a long time. He sent me a text after the video went out, and he said, I've been in politics my whole life. Everyone says they're leaving to spend more time with family. You're the first one I believe. So I appreciate that. But it is, you know, as I said,
kids are younger, right?
Yeah, they're 10 and 6. And, you know, when I first got in Congress, I had no kids. And now I have two. And it changes when they start to get playing sports and this and that. And we were going back and forth, you know, for years. We'd make that drive all the time. The kids were good. We'd do it in 8 hours. And
I know that drive.
I've driven it. It's hard.
Well, what's fun is
you want to fly it. It makes you want to fly.
Are you? Do you do the turnpike, or do you go through
we
Maryland?
We go through the mountains.
Yeah. Through, gosh, what's that called?
Allegheny, right?
No. I'm thinking of the that big,
Breezewood?
No. It'll come to me.
I'll tell you, we stop at the truck stop, which is Love's and McDonald's.
I know.
We'd stop there, and, you know, we'd do the convenience stop. We'd fill up with gas, change a diaper, and then move on. And I had several seasons of Andy Griffith. My son knows all the characters on Andy Griffith, which not too many kids his generation will know.
Good for you. That is a random reference I didn't expect today.
Yeah, there you go. So,
And mostly kids today watch YouTube, apparently. according to my child.
Well, he still watches that. And I got him onto the Dick Van Dyke Show. So,
it's God's work.
He'll get into the
God's work.
He'll get into the sensory eventually.
Okay. So you did. Like, that's a real thing. Like, you have to be away. There's like, to do the job right, you have to be away in DC and they have to be here. So it's hard.
Yeah. But you know, through this job, I've met so many people throughout Cincinnati, Southern Ohio, and so many entities I didn't know exist. And, you know, the things that I can hopefully be involved with. I've always enjoyed being involved with philanthropy. I'm involved with Boys Hope, Girls Hope, and have been. Although when you get elected to Congress, you can't be on certain boards, but you can be advisory board, but not on the board. Anyway, there'll be things that I can get back into locally, as well as hopefully still work on some national, international issues, you know, somehow. Consulting or whatever.
Do you know what you're going to do next?
No, I don't. And, There are all sorts of ethics rules about how much you can engage in that. People can talk to you about possibilities, but you can't get too deep into it. You can't talk money. You can't do.
Will anything. You open a practice again? Do you want to go back?
I've had three orthopedic groups.
I bet you have.
ask me if I'm interested in going back to clinical work. And I think I would maybe do one day a week or be involved with a residency or something like that.
Because you do have to have your insurance and everything goes along with that, right?
That's what made it tough to practice, and that's why I was glad I was still in the reserves, because then I'm covered and I could do things that way. And I could even do things at UC because they have the Air Force there doing a lot of surgical training and training for critical care air transport teams they do at UC. So I was able to participate in those in uniform, but then also being at Walter Reed. But that is the problem. And there's another member of Congress, Greg Murphy, North Carolina. He's a urologist. He still practices when he goes home, but he doesn't get paid.
Okay.
You're limited on income.
I do. You've been pretty quiet on this subject matter, and I feel like you're still going to be quiet, but I'm going to ask anyway. So we have 11 Republicans running for your seat in the primary. Are you planning on endorsing?
No, and for good reason.
Is it because it's hard to pick?
No, several people have been helpful to me along the way. They were either, you know, contributors or helping holding political office. I thought it was best to stay out. I don't want to burn any bridges with, you know, some good people. There's a lot of people I didn't know before that are in the race, but and still don't. with I think it's 11 that are running.
We're down. Yeah,
and,
11.
You know, my goal is to be helpful to whoever wins the primary, as Rob Portman was for me. When I won my primary, he right away set up a chance for me to go with him because he'd cover that area for a long time, and to go with him and meet people in the district and tell me more about each of the counties that I didn't know very well. And so I hope to be able to do that.
Is there a book in your future as you took us through all these experiences that you've had?
People have asked me that, and I'm like, I guess I'll give you the Dr. Fauci. I wouldn't know how to do that. but I think there are people that can guide you through it. Maybe, but I don't have that on my plate as something I'm aspiring to necessarily, because there's still more I want to do.
Well, we appreciate the time.
I know, and we are over time. I know, but I have to ask. Only because, now you can say yes, you can say no. You know, we had Greg Landsman on several weeks ago now, and we went down, you know, a rabbit hole where he did talk about his coworkers in Congress. And I took a lot of heat for that. I did, which is to be fair. And please tell our listeners and readers, we have asked for a little bit. You've been so busy though. Like, we're not just want to have one party on the podcast. We ask everybody, you guys, but schedules don't always, you know, I don't talk about who we asked and, you know, why they are or aren't doing the podcast. And so he did talk about his coworkers. Do you want to say, do you have favorites? Who, like, that we would be surprised by? Because he kind of went down the list.
Favorites that he works with?
Or people we'd be surprised by.
Yeah, I don't think you'd be surprised because, and if you're talking about cross the aisle favorites, is that where you're going?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, well, you know, it's some of the docs and some of the veterans, and those who I work with pretty well, and you find it on your committees, you know. So like, you know, people always want to say like, what's AOC like? I was like, I've never had a conversation with her. She's not on any of my committees, and it just nothing comes up, and I just don't see any need to go there. It was interesting because CBS was doing a story. I think it was CBS, might have been ABC, so I apologize. But they were doing a story on those that were retiring. And one came up to me and he said, you know, I was talking to Earl Blumenauer, who's retiring. Earl's Democrat from Oregon. And I asked him what he's going to miss. And he said, working with Brad Winstrup. All right. So these are things nobody sees, right?
Right.
People, you know, we know where we differ. It was kind of same with Mark Mallory. I know where we differ, but there's a lot of common ground there. And I didn't go to Washington to hate anybody. You know, there's some I just avoid in my own party too. So, you know, it's where can we get things done? Who can I work with? And in that case, Earl Blumenauer is one of them, but across the aisle, you know, it's mostly probably the veterans and the other doctors that you can find things that, hey, we can get this done, right? You know, we can do it. But it's not just them. It's just others. So it's personalities. And I'll tell you, there's several people that
there's no shortage of personalities.
No, not at all.
Out on a limb there.
Not at all. But I will tell you, there's people that are one way in front of C-SPAN and another way when you go in the back room. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you an example. We got the VA Mission Act done when I was chairing health on VA. And we got that done where every member of the committee, we were all co-sponsors of the bill. Every member. And the way we got so much done is when we had roundtables off camera, invited the VA, invited the veterans group, VFW and this and that, and we had conversations about how we thought it could work. So here we are talking to the people that use the VA system, right? And we have the people that run the VA system sitting around a table, no cameras. That's how we got that bill done. So you can get things done but the American people mostly see energized interviews and what's in front of C-SPAN.
Very good euphemism. Let's go back to the very beginning. So you're working on a bill related to some of the weight loss drugs. Mm-hmm. Who are you working on that bill with, and is it going to pass, do you think?
Dr. Raul Ruiz.
Okay.
Yeah, he's a co-sponsor with me. We've got a couple others, but I know he's one of the leaders on that with me, and we have prior authorization bill we've worked with on called the Safe Step Act. It's for prior authorization for your medications. We don't want a system that delays care for patients because the insurance company says, we think you should prescribe a different drug. People that never saw the patient telling you what to prescribe. That's a very interesting concept, right? I never minded if a pharmacist said, hey, you know, this is cheaper for your patient. Have you thought about this? Well, I'm like, oh yeah, that'll do the same thing I want. That's fine. But you have reasons sometimes for a certain drug and they say no. And you know that that drug they're recommending failed them in the past, right? So, you know, there are things we can work on like that. But for that particular bill with the obesity, it's Dr. Ruiz.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us
today. I had a quick follow-up question.
Yes,
way back. We could have just done a podcast on your work on the subcommittee studying the coronavirus. But you mentioned you had a test to determine your antibodies. Is that a test that's easily accessible, like through your general practitioner?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and some are doing that now. But see, you took the doctor out of it, and that was the problem. And in my mind, that was the problem. You had people, and with the mandates, for example, you were kicking people out of the military that maybe had COVID and had more antibodies than those that got vaccinated. This makes no sense. Why were we doing this? No one can explain it.
And for the layperson, it really doesn't matter if you get the antibodies through a vaccine or herd mentality, or you've had the illness and your body has built them. Antibodies are antibodies, right?
Yes. And I remember a Cincinnati Enquirer article about a guy who got COVID, was deathly ill, and he got convalescent plasma. Remember that term?
Right. Yeah.
And he said, I was better in a day. He got somebody else's antibodies that matched him, that donated their plasma, that took the antibodies, and he got them, and he did well. We dropped talking about that as a treatment. Why? These things are real. They're not new. So why weren't we engaging with this? This is part of what I want to look at, is we're having this committee. Why did we drop these things and not talk about them anymore? Why didn't we not accelerate the idea for hospitals to have more blood drives? Hawksworth was good about it at the beginning. They wanted it, and this guy got it. You wrote a really nice article, not you necessarily, but it was a really good article about how he was saved by this. So a lot of things need to be answered. Another important component is T cells. That's sometimes a little harder to get. That's part of your immune system. I wanted that when I asked for mine, and they said, well, we don't do it here, but we can get your antibodies. So then you have a decision process with your doctor, and you can say, well, yeah, but that's, you got COVID then, and this is a new variant that's more infectious. So maybe not so good. You might still need a booster for that. But again, those are the legitimate conversations that would take place, that should take place in healthcare. What Dr. Fauci said when we asked him about the mandate, which he was in favor of, he said, I did a bad job estimating the psyche of the American people. Because I can tell you, I said from the very beginning, this goes to whether they should get vaccinated or not. I did a thing with people that were hesitant. And what it came down to, they said, we just want to be educated, not indoctrinated. That's the American people. Americans don't do well with because I told you so.
I agree with that. I definitely agree with that.
Oh, here, now you're going to extend the podcast. Producer Phil, he's given us the hand signal.
I'm having a good time.
I have two more questions.
Well, I have a quick follow-up to what you just said there.
Okay.
So we have a recurring feature that actually started during our coverage of the pandemic called Ask the Doctor. So if you wouldn't mind taking off your congressman hat and putting your doctor hat back on, I'm curious, what would be your recommendation to somebody who is wrestling with whether they not or not they should get the booster vaccine? Is it just as simple as going to your doctor and saying, you know, what is the best plan for me? What should they know? How should they prepare for that conversation?
So you're talking about with COVID in particular. Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's a lot more we know, and we were learning pretty early, even in the trials. Well, who's more vulnerable, right? And we knew if you had diabetes, if you had obesity, if you had some immune disorder, I mean, the immune disorder especially is a given, right? That, you know, you're more vulnerable. We also knew that if you got the vaccine and you got COVID, you were less likely to be as sick and less likely to be hospitalized. But there were still people that were vaccinated that died from COVID. The numbers were greatly reduced. So we did a good thing with the vaccine, especially for emergency use for the vulnerable. But as we're learning, other people weren't vulnerable. That's what you want to have the conversation with about your doctor, with your doctor. Are you vulnerable to this? Whether it's your age or whatever. If you have no underlying medical condition and you're 25 years old, you're not as vulnerable to death anyway. You can get COVID, but a lot of people are getting COVID that didn't even know it. The only reason I knew when I got COVID is because I was cooking and I couldn't smell garlic salt. I snorted it. Nothing. Now you know.
But you had no symptoms. Right. You weren't fatigued. You weren't.
I had chills
fevered.
About a week before.
Okay.
I turned to my wife and I said, I must have had COVID. Remember when I said I got chills today? So put two and two together.
Yeah.
Right. So those are the conversations you would have.
Meanwhile, your family had a very over-garliced whatever dish
exactly.
You were making.
but at the same time, and I've said this is a word of caution, but I hear members of Congress say, no, these vaccines are safe and effective. They have been very effective, But even Dr. Fauci said, when we had him there now, he said, you can never say something's 100% safe. You know, Debbie Dingell, who's a member of Congress from Michigan, she told the world that she got Guillain-Barré from a vaccine when she was younger. She was able to have a conversation with her doctor about this vaccine. And did the benefits outweigh the risk for her? And she says that. And so she's on board with, we could have done better there, right?
Do you think that this issue is so important that it should play a big role in what people are thinking about when they go to vote in the presidential election? Because there's so many things to consider.
I tell you why I would say I hope not. Because unless the president is a immunologist, virologist, whatever, it shouldn't matter.
Neither candidate is at this point.
And HHS should be agnostic and should not be playing games. But look, I'm just going to tell you, most of the people that speak out and said, oh, this came from nature and they don't have any real proof, they didn't look at the lab. They didn't even look at it. I asked Dr. Fauci, you now say it's not a conspiracy theory to consider the lab, but have you looked at, and I rattled off all these scientists that talked about how it could be made in the lab. I said, have you looked at, I rattled off their names. And he said, no. We need an agency that is agnostic, that is not trying to cover something up. Think about this. HHS is over NIH. NIH gave grants to EcoHealth Alliance to do that type of research in China. Look, I would rather it came from nature, because the fact that it can be done in a lab, period, whether this one came from nature or not, is a frightening thing. And in particular, China, our State Department said China's working on bioweapons. They said that back in 2005. In 2015, they published a book about genetic bioweapons. Now, are they creating something to be on offense, or so they can defend themselves? That's a question that remains. But these are the concerns that I have. So what people should be asking their next president is, are you going to insist that Health and Human Services is run better with more oversight and apolitical, because health is not political?
And we have talked a lot about politics. I'm going to veer off for a little, I think maybe what our last question.
You're the boss, Sherry. This is your fourth last question. I just want to point this out to you.
Anyone who's ever been interviewed by me knows that it does go like this. A lot has been said in recent days about President Biden and his age. You are a doctor. Do you feel like people need to consider what has been said and a person's age when they're going to vote for president?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily age, because I see some 90-year-olds that are just phenomenal. And you wonder how they did it. And I usually would ask them as a doctor, yeah, how did you do it? Because I'm hoping to have the same. But I don't think it's age. Particularly, I think it is, you know, where you are. You know, people said that about Ronald Reagan as he was, you know, ending his term. People questioned, you know, what he could remember and things like that. And then you saw that he did have dementia, right?
I was just going to say that, yeah.
And he admitted it to the American people. It was funny because people insisted that Donald Trump be tested on his mental capabilities, and he went through it. So I think it's fair to consider that president's mental status, whether it happened while they're in office or if it's there before, I think it's fair. There's too much on the line. And so it doesn't matter which party it is. I think that that's a fair consideration.
From where you sit, do you think there's an issue?
Well, I can say I've seen a lot of similar things with patients over the years in my practice, where you start to see it. And, you know, where I ended up giving advice is to a spouse a lot of times. It's like, you can't handle this on your own anymore. And best thing for your health is to get help for this person. My uncle, I mean, we saw it coming. He saw it coming. He started saying to me, gosh, Brad, I can't remember this. I can't remember all these things anymore. It's really terrible. And it went to full-blown dementia. You know?
Do you have concerns about the president?
Oh, sure. Sure. I think that's fair. And that was certainly an assessment that was made by a professional who was talking to him. And I feel badly for him. You know, we don't like seeing this happen to anybody. That's why I'm a big supporter of trying to find medications that can treat this. The medicine that we have now, again, FDA approved, but not approved by CMS, especially for Medicare patients. This is where they need it. But it's true, this medicine has its greatest effect if you're catching it early and treating someone early. And now there's starting to be some definitive tests that you can look and say, yeah, you're on that path. So this medicine can help you. But if it's too far gone, it's too late, don't prescribe it.
All right. Well, we're going to shut off Sherry's mic. Go ahead, Phil. And I'm going to wrap this up. Thank you so much, Congressman Wenstrup, for the time you spent with us today. Like I said, we talked about four or five different topics. Each one of them could have been a podcast. You've had such a, how should we say, active career in Congress, probably comparatively speaking. I can't think of anybody who's been involved in more things, especially recently representing our part of the country. So thank you for that. Thank you for your service, and thank you for your time today.
It's all been an honor, and no regrets, but it's time to venture out and be dad and husband a little
well,
bit
good
more.
Luck with that.
And coach, I hope.
Oh, there we go. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I can't help myself, for all. I'm a talker. It just goes long. I'm sorry, you guys. Thanks for listening all the way through. Because if you're at this point, you did do that for me. I appreciate that. I feel like I did ask some tough questions, and he answered some tough questions, and he didn't have any problem doing that.
No, he never has. And especially since he's not running for re-election.
Well, right.
I don't want to say, you know, he didn't have to... he didn't have to be as diplomatic in his answers as he might have been.
That's true. That's true.
And he is, you know, I want to thank him again for his time. He spent a lot of time with us. He is a busy person, as you could tell by all the things he was involved with. You know, not the least of which is his involvement with the subcommittee studying the origins of COVID. I think, you know, I learned a lot from just talking to him. Gave me some perspective, I think, that's important to have. And so we'll see where all that goes. It's fascinating. Fascinating, I tell you. But on a much lighter note, I did feel like I took part indirectly by proxy in a greater Cincinnati moment this week.
Ooh, do tell.
In fact, it was a That's So Batesville moment.
Okay.
Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, you President's went to get Day. Cherry thingalings.
I did not go to get cherry thingalings, but Lauren.
Okay.
So Lauren.
By proxy, I see.
Yes. So Lauren, for this year, decided to maximize her life. And, I'll have to get more information on this if people are interested, but she ended up, I think she listened to a podcast, and one of the things that this podcast host recommends is, and he has the product to sell, it's the Big Ass Calendar. Have you heard of the Big Ass Calendar?
I have. My friend Julie's doing it.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So she orders this thing. It's so big, I have to
said it's like over her desk and it's gigantic.
Oh, it's gigantic.
Because you have to see it a year at a glance is the thing.
Year at a glance. And so it's hanging in the bedroom that she uses as her work from home office. And it takes up the whole wall, and it comes with sticky notes mm-hmm. that are the right size to fit in the little squares. And the gist of it is, you know, you have your job, and in any given year, it's easy to say, well, I don't have time to do anything. But if you just look at all the, if you like block out the days you're working and you look at all the other days and all the opportunities you have, you know, activities big and small you can do. So planning trips or more time with your family or, you know, Lauren's trying to wrap up a master's degree. I mean, just making good use of your time, not doing the doom scroll on TikTok, you know, getting out.
I never do that.
No, nobody ever does that. One of the things that she decided she was going to do this year on her bucket list was go and get Cherry Thingalings on President's Day weekend.
Okay.
So she went Sunday. She didn't go early enough. And you know how long she waited in line?
I've waited 3 hours. How long did she wait?
Yes, exactly. It was 2 hours, 59 minutes.
I have to tell you, though, you meet very interesting people. It does go quickly because there's people from all over there. You're all kind of there for the same reason. And I have met delightful people in that line. I did not go this year. Shout out to my fairy godfather thing-a-ling delivery. they were on my porch when I went to Louisville. And so that was bad planning on my part because I got back too late to get Cherry Thingalings. And they're so good. So, I'm glad she went.
So
you should have went with her. There's nothing like a fresh cherry thingaling.
That's what she said. Especially, I was in trouble because
you can't have them in the newsroom and do a TikTok. You can't have them in your house. There's nothing like a fresh.
No, I'm glad you mentioned the TikTok. If you haven't seen our TikTok,
Carl
interviewing the folks at the bakery about how it started and how they make them and how many they do. It's fascinating. So check that out. But yes, I got in trouble because she said that others who were in line with her were in small groups or at least couples so that someone could go get coffee and come back. Someone could go to the bathroom and come back. No, I left her high and dry, but she brought them home. They were still warm. And she also brought back it looked like a giant Hostess Ho-Ho, but it was a cherry, like, rolled up thing.
Did she bring the cherry wine back?
No cherry wine.
It's for the best, bro.
Yeah, probably. but she crossed an item off her bucket list. She participated in the Cherry Thingaling extravaganza of 2004.
Okay, so did I, but by eating some.
Yes.
The rest have to go, though. Alex was warned this morning when I get home from work today, they ought to be gone because I'm on a diet.
Yeah, it is pretty fascinating that a little family bakery
so good.
Caught fire with an idea and it's become such a tradition. And the number of thingalings that they produce is, you know, growing each year.
You know, I saw the number today. Every year they do break the record, but it becomes like more and more of a thing, honestly, every year.
It does. And what Lauren observed was they really don't change the workflow of the bakery much that day, which is why it takes a little longer. But when she finally got in there, they were coming right out of the fryer. You know, they're not going to like do a bunch in advance and freeze them and give you a less than perfect thingling experience. So that was it, Sherry. That is
a Cincinnati moment.
By proxy, I participated or not.
I was
in a little bit of trouble for
all
that.
All right, Sheena, I'll have to talk about the calendar. You guys, you do have to have talked about this before for sure. You do have to plan to get all the things done. I've been a poor planner so far this year. We were just planning out some podcasts, and Lisa, who books our guests, is amazing. And she's like, when are you going to be off? I'm like, I don't know. I've really done not enough planning. I need to do
that.
You got to
plan. And I'm not just being flip when I say it's a big ass calendar. That's like, it's big ass calendar trademark, you know? But it's funny. On top of the calendar, it doesn't say big ass calendar. It says big A ##, or ##, calendar.
Well, kids could see it.
Yeah, kids could see it. You
All
know,
right.
Because
we'll have to connect her with Julie because I know that Julie is this. They're friends, and Julie has this.
Well, I'm way too disorganized and fly by the seat of my pants. I'm gonna design the alternative, the fly by your seat of the pants calendar. It's going to be small.
Okay, yeah.
It's just going to have, you know, space for like a few important dates, like maybe like your significant other's birthday.
Dinner and Blanc.
dinner in Blanc.
What is
how in the world did you manage to wedge dinner in Blanc into this conversation?
Well, if I was making a big ass calendar, I would put that on there like right away.
So then
I
Sherry's wouldn't go away
during that weekend.
You would need many. You would need like double the space, I think, with as much living as you cram in.
I think it is telling, though, who has a paper calendar and who has a uses their phone solely. Because I kind of do a combination of both, which is probably not the best.
Yeah.
But at one of the railroad boards, one of the railroad board members, because they were going to plan their next meeting, they were like, when could they all get together? And they're like talking about the next date. And he whipped out like the old school like paper calendar. And yeah. Some of the other members were making fun of him. But I was like, I know. Because you really see the month at a glance. And it's helpful.
So I was cracking up because Rocky Boyman, who sports announcer, former St. X High School, Notre Dame, won the Super Bowl with the Colts, WLW host. He's on a committee that I'm working on, tied to the Boy Scouts. And we're on a Zoom call trying to get dates organized for something we were working on. And he pulled out, like, his calendar is a desk blotter calendar. Like, that Whoa. Was his calendar.
See, it's a telling yeah. thing about a
and,
person.
And so, like, on the Zoom, all of a sudden, he's got this big, not quite as big as the big-ass calendar, but he's flipping through a desk blotter calendar. And I'm thinking, well, that's not very handy if you're out and about, but maybe he's got some, you know, elaborate system to tie it into the calendar on his phone or whatever. But I hadn't seen a desk blotter calendar used in reality for a while.
The mayor's, I've seen the mayor's calendar on his phone. He showed me one time to show me how busy he was when we were trying to
make
a plan.
Very busy, yes.
Well, he's the mayor, so fair enough. It's color-coded, and I was blown away and was like, it's so far out of my planning reach to have something that looked like that, but it did seem like it worked.
Well, anyway, well, that was a lot.
Okay.
So, yeah. Like I said, I'm gonna be rich. I'm gonna design the fly by your seat
okay.
of your pants calendar.
I might use that
for the rest of us out there.
All right, my life is a little fly by the seat. I mean, you don't know when you're a reporter when you get up in the morning what's going to be happening. You just have to roll with it.
I think that's what draws a lot of people to the type of journalism we do. You know, like I wouldn't be good working, you know, on a magazine format if I don't have the daily deadline or now, you know, the hour by hour deadline.
Same.
You know, to create that sense of urgency, like a long project. And I was that way in school. You know, let's say you had the whole semester to work on, you know, a paper or a project. When did you start? Did you start right away?
I mean, I did.
You did? Oh. I think, you know, there's two types of people in the world, those that do that and those that don't. So I know where I fall. I admit it.
Okay.
Drives Lauren crazy, but...
Well, now you have a calendar on the wall that you can look at.
all the big-ass calendar in our house does is shame me because I look at it and realize I don't even know what I'm doing next week, and she's planned out for most of the year.
All
so
right, well, I feel like you're probably in some of those plans. So
probably.
Just,
yeah, some of them involve both of us. Yes. All right, well, should we wrap this up?
Yeah, let's do it. Okay, this was a long one.
It's you, Sherry.
All right,
you
thank
start.
You. All right, thank you for listening to That So Cincinnati podcast, a production of The Enquirer and Cincinnati.com.
That So Cincinnati is sponsored this week again by Cincinnati.com, the online home of The Enquirer. If you'd like to sponsor an episode listened to by thousands each week, email me personally at belove@cincinnati.com.
That So Cincinnati was produced today by Phil Didion.
Yay, Phil!
Lisa Gillespie books our guests. If you like what you're hearing, please subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and share us with a friend.
And finally, if you value local journalism, please consider a digital subscription to The Enquirer. Just click on subscribe at the top of cincinnati.com. And remember, she came down from Cincinnati and it took her 3 days on the train.
Finally, one I know.